been writing about big tech and making art about big tech and this whole machine versus human situation. I've been doing that for a few years before 2020. And I was kind of concerned about it, but I thought that surely that was going to happen after my lifetime. But yeah, I mean, that was a big danger and they were crazy, but I could not even imagine that it would start happening, that they would try to do it during my lifetime. So I'm tripping over that. It's completely insane. And I also am looking for ways to try to rebuild the physical community, because that is the main thing. And I think last year has shown to everybody that we really need each other, like physically, touching, hugging, all those things.
Welcome to Freedom Loves Company on ProgressiveSpirit.net and JohnShuck.com. I'm John Shuck. Freedom Loves Company is broadcast live every Sunday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Revolution.radio Studio B, and slightly edited for podcast and distribution through the Pacifica Radio Network. Tessa Lena is on with me. Tessa, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, hi, wonderful.
John. Thank you for having me on.
Wonderful. I'm so glad you're here. Let me give you a proper introduction. Now, my name is John Shuck. My new show is Freedom Loves Company. This is so new, it's the first broadcast of it tonight. Just had Kevin Barrett in the first hour, and now Tessa Lena here in the second hour. Revolution Radio is a great network and about freedom of speech, so we can talk about what needs to be talked about. And I'm very excited to be here on Revolution Radio, and I will be here every Sunday in Studio B from 8 to 10 Eastern Time. And with me now from New York is Tessa Lena. Tessa Lena is a strongly opinionated musician living in New York. She is a classically trained pianist and singer born and raised in Moscow. As a teenager, Tessa had the honor of performing her own composition entitled In Defense of the Environment at the Moscow Conservatory, and wanted to be a geneticist. As her interests expanded to Tibetan music and language, she headed to Lhasa with a backpack to do a field study in linguistics and ethnomusicology. After being attacked by a sex trafficker in southern China and successfully fighting him off, Tessa settled in Chicago. In Chicago, she started a band working with her hero Ian McDonald of King Crimson and Foreigner, and drummer Alan Lake, who has played and recorded with Madonna, Brian Ferry, Julian Lennon, Ministry, Brian Wilson, and Sam Moore from Sam and Dave. After a few years in Chicago, Tessa moved to New York and started a new band, Tessa Makes Love, along with occasional collaborations by Ian McDonald. In 2013, her music video, Spenta la Stella, received over 1 million very useful views on YouTube, although the jury is still out, she says, on how many people realize that the video was a satire making fun of sexual objectification. Alas, the world keeps spinning and it's still imperfect. In 2016, Tessa started a coalition for artistic dignity and organized a conference in Brooklyn dedicated to artistic dignity, social power, and corporate responsibility. In early 2017, she released an album titled Tessa Fights Robots, and you can listen and buy it on her website. Since the English language has so many words, her blog is also called Tessa Fights Robots. Both the album and the blog are about being human in the world of technology, big data, and machine-like people. So Tessa Makes Love and Tessa Fights Robots. Tessa Lena is with me from New York City. Tessa, welcome to Freedom Loves Company.
Thank you, and thank you for such a wonderful and lengthy introduction. It's an honor to be here.
So the big question we're going to ask, Tessa Makes Love, Tessa Fights Robots, what do you like to do most?
Both. They're kind of the same thing.
Are they the same thing? Yeah, we certainly have to fight the robots to get to making love, I think.
Oh, well, at this point in history, I think you're correct.
What I want to take time this hour with you this hour is take some time and learn your story. I think it's fascinating. I follow you on Twitter, and I'm just amazed at the beautiful things you write and so many pieces of philosophy and spirituality, as well as the political stuff. You were tell me about your life in the Soviet Union. and compare that here.
I grew up at the ruins of the Soviet Union, and as a kid, everything is wonderful. I think usually when you're a kid, like all the things that adults worry about, they don't worry at all. So I just really enjoyed myself. But now I got to realize, and thinking back, like one of the things that I really resented was that all adults were miserable, like to my view. And I realized that it was very much a generational thing, like the generation of my grandparents, for example. They were born very shortly after the revolution of 1917. So they were raised into that system, which was essentially a machine using very nice slogans, but those slogans were just a pretense. So it was a machine. But that was the only thing they knew. So they were a very, very harsh generation, a very strong generation who had to go through the war, and they defeated the Nazi, and they were very, very harsh. And they really identified with the machine in many ways. So that was the only way they knew how to think, because they were born into that. So they raised the generation of my parents in a very specific way. And the generation of my grandparents were kind of this interim generation where their parents, in a way, sided with the machine, which broke their kids in many ways. And I think they were kind of like a sad generation. Obviously, that's a big generalization, but then they tried to pass this sadness to my generation, and we wanted none of it. And what I remember from my childhood is that the adults were just really, really unhappy. And many, many of them, because somehow culturally unhappiness has been accepted as something that is a normal state. And yes, you're allowed to strive for happiness. You strive for happiness, but you're not really expected to accomplish it. And so misery was kind of associated and almost viewed as synonymous to understanding life. So if you understand life, then you kind of accept suffering. And I hated it. That was actually the reason why I immigrated to the States. It was not anything political. I just really wanted to run away from that never-ending melancholy and that self-punishment. I just ran away. And then, of course, I discovered that here it wasn't perfect either. It was a different kind of beast. So American Beast was full of glitter and full of fake smiles, and how are you fine? I mean, but underneath, there was still great disrespect for the spirit and for who you are, who you're born to be. And of course, now I'm seeing a lot of the things that I didn't like back then, like things that were the remnants of the Soviet Union, this whole conformism, that you have to conform or else you're a bad person, and that replacement of real community values with state-mandated community values, which is a deceit. I mean, it is not real. It has nothing to do with happiness or caring about people. All of a sudden, I see it here full force, and I just can't take it seriously, because I already witnessed that entire beast left out of the room in my formative years. So when I see it here, it's almost absurd. I'm tripping every day because I am recognizing the style of propaganda, even the visual style of propaganda, the details of linguistic quirks of coming from mainstream media today in the States. But I thought they were left out of the room back then, you know, when I was little in the Soviet Union. So it's a total trip. I hope I answered your question with this long-winded statement.
That was very good. And I want to talk about some more specific things of what you said. So when you left the Soviet Union, was it still the Soviet Union or was it after?
No. It was after. It was not the Soviet Union. And it was in the, in fact, the 90s. I remember the 90s over there and I loved it. I think most Americans perceive that the 90s in the post-Soviet space were just this horrible thing where everything was torn apart by Western corporations, which is true. I mean, they really used, the Western corporations used all the slogans about freedom and such to clear the market for themselves. I mean, that unfortunately is how it was. But from a child's perspective or like teenager's perspective, it was really beautiful because all the Western music came in and all the, you know, people really celebrated this new freedom. And well, for better or for worse, from what I remember, everybody actually, well, everybody except the oligarchs, perhaps, and whoever, like very, very rich people, we actually thought it was for real. Like people decided that now politicians are going to be honest and there was this awakening, like you can say whatever you want, you can make art about anything you want. And people really, really cherished, from what I remember, this newly found freedom of expression. So like, I don't take it lightly, like all the censorship that is happening right now here, because I remember how precious it was to people who lived without it.
Right. Well, by the way, I want to let you know that Kevin Barrett says hello. I just had him on the first hour, and I told him that. So that's wonderful. When you mentioned oligarchs, it triggered that for me. Not that he's one, but that he exposes them. Yes. You said early on, and you're talking about living in your grandparents and your parents, the machine. What can you put more? Tell me more about what the machine was then.
Well, the machine, by the time I was around, the machine was barely dragging its feet because nobody took it seriously anymore, and it was more like a living corpse. I mean, you couldn't say certain things, and I mean, there were a lot of things that you couldn't say, but everybody knew it was just kind of the game that everybody plays, which I think prior to, say, a couple of decades earlier, it wasn't the case. People believed in it. And then a couple decades even earlier, people really, really believed in it. But by the time I was around, nobody believed in any of that. And it was just like cashiers who yell at you and you have no rights whatsoever. And you have to conform and everybody's unhappy. And there was this fanatical atheism that then quickly shifted to fanatical, well, Christianity mostly, Orthodox Christianity, but the same degree of fanaticism. So it was kind of just mostly simple and bleak in a way that it lacked zest or it lacked spice. It wasn't horrible from a child's perspective, again, because like as a child, you interact with your adults and with your friends and you don't really care about much. But actually, I remember a funny thing. I started reading when I was very young, like, you know, 2 or 3, something like that. And it was perfectly fine to walk around the street, you know, on your block without parents. By the time I was like 4 or 5, I mean, I could walk to the library. So I went to the library and I found a book in the library that was called You Are Going to Live During Communism. And I thought as a child that it was an extremely important book. And I felt so smart that I found this book clearly written for very smart people and for adults. And I brought it with such delight. I brought it home and I felt like, you know, my parents would praise me and think, you're such a smart kid. You picked this like really smart book about living during communism. And they laughed and they said it was some kind of Khrushchev era nonsense. So that was very disappointing. But I just remember that feeling that I think it is kind of related to what a lot of people are doing today, even adults. It's kind of using this slogan or this talking point that you identify with, and then you feel smart, and you expect to be praised for that. I think this is kind of a psychological trick that I experienced for the first time accidentally as a kid. I think this is what is happening in adult life a lot today in America. What do you think about that?
Yes, yes. So this machine that we're talking about, it's not just the government. It is the government, but it's a way of living that takes away our spirit in some respect. Is that right?
Essentially, yes. And I think, well, machine has many faces and many ways to express itself, but I think that the state, I mean, ultimately the state is still people. It's still people initiating it in a certain way, people running it in a certain way. And yeah, it is the state of thinking and a way that in which your spiritual freedom doesn't matter, in which it doesn't matter what your heart wants. Well, if your heart happens to want at the moment the same thing as the machine wants, then good for you. Like, you know, you'll be elevated. But if, God forbid, you want something else, like back in the Soviet Union, for instance, if you wanted to play classical music, you were a very lucky person and you would have a lot of support and your talent will be nourished and you would actually have a good life. But if you wanted to play jazz, then you wouldn't be able to, because that is like off, that is capitalist and horrible and bourgeois, and it's just criminal to do that and think about it. So it really depended on your natural inclination, what you wanted to do. And But in essence, it is that stale structure that puts rules in front of the spirit, essentially.
Yeah, so the machine has just a number of different faces then, doesn't it? In different places.
Yep, exactly.
So here in the United States now, I'm thinking, well, it's been here for a long time, but it certainly has hit us since March of 2020 or earlier with this whole COVID thing. And, you know, you're talking about machines and children, my gosh, you know, in school and wearing these masks. And is what do you think is the big picture, if I can ask that, of what's happening to us since these lockdowns?
Oh God, that and the meaning of life.
Yeah, I guess
you know,
so. Maybe
very small questions.
Yeah, could you do that in 37 seconds, okay?
Well, I think that what happened last year revealed the aches and the hunger and the trauma and the messes that existed prior to. I think also that the 4 years that preceded that and all the propaganda and the divisiveness from all ends, they kind of primed a certain group of people for losing their wits. And so by the time 2020 happened, people were already so, in a way, confused in thinking, and I'm saying it without any judgment. I mean, it's just stress.
Mm-hmm.
Like
sure.
Stress impacts you on the physical level, and whether stress is based on real dangers or perceived dangers, the body reacts similarly. So I think when 2020 hit, many people were primed for conformism because they were already stressed out to know, like, to greatly. And even prior to, if you look at the American culture and American society, again, respect for the spirit didn't really exist much. So there was comfort, there was the ability to make money in certain fields, but that respect for who you are is something that everybody needs. It's just the need we are born with. And if we don't get it, we might tell fairy tales to ourselves, or we might, you know, replace it with money or whatever. But that need is still present and it doesn't go anywhere. And it was not really satisfied for many people. And for instance, the reason why so many people embraced masks, I think a part of it is, yes, they were scared out of their minds by the media and all the strange science and all that. But a part of it is that lots of people, maybe they kind of felt invisible already, and they felt the pressure to pretend to be social and pretend to be, you know, cheery and talking to everybody and tell the story about how successful they are and all that. And then all of a sudden they were given an excuse to not do any of that. So they can put on a mask and be gloomy under the mask. And that was not only accepted, but actually encouraged. So in a way, the sad, broken state was equated with being a good citizen. And so they received almost like an indulgence for actually not being very happy. So I think that is the reason why a lot of people actually accepted it. Well, plus, of course, propaganda is a very interesting beast. It actually does work. And it does work like an abuser. And especially in this country, a lot of the people have the habit of generally trusting the system. Like, you know, you can think that somebody's corrupt or somebody's incompetent, and that's assumed. But generally, the assumption is that the machine works as, you know, as expected. It runs smoothly. So it is a very hard and giant leap to accept the fact that they can be abused, that they, the important people, the people with a status or the people with a career or whatnot, that they are actually on the receiving end of this giant abuse. It is a huge blow to the ego. And that is, I think, another reason why so many people went for that. And granted, last year, I freaked out very briefly last year because, of course, in last March, nobody knew what was happening and anything was possible. And people thought whether it's this or whether it's that or whether it's a virus or a bioweapon, or, you know, and everybody, I think, wore masks for like, you know, a couple of weeks or whatever, a month. Then, of course, in my case, I distinctly remember I was in line for groceries and I was wearing a mask. And then a drunk guy passed by me and I smelled every molecule of liquor he ever had. And I was thinking, oh, that's interesting. So if he has a virus, then I have it. So that kind of deconvinced me from the usefulness of that. So, but again, the propaganda and the peer pressure, and they used the compassion card, which I think was another significant trick, because specifically in America, in big cities, in the intelligentsia crowd, the community is not really present much. So it's all the ego and the competition, like career, you publish a book, or, you know, who follows you and all those things. So the human element is to a large degree missing or underrepresented. So when somebody smart with a smart marketing background and smart psychology background created this idea that by conforming, you are being compassionate, and by conforming, you're part of the community. So I think a lot of people went for that just because in some way they were missing this community feeling so badly. So they were like an abused child, essentially. So you give them something, you give them some semblance of love and community and belonging, and they just get it, you know, they go for it.
If you are just joining us on Freedom Loves Company, my name is John Scheck, and Freedom Loves Company is a brand new show on Revolution Radio. My guest is Tessa Lena. Her website, her blog site is Tessa Fights Robots, and she has a band, Tessa Makes Love, and that's also her Twitter handle. And we're talking about this machine, you know, and you mentioned, I thought it was very insightful what you were saying, what this does to us as humans, the idea of this masking, this making ourselves more miserable is somehow virtuous. And we're being more compassionate in the church setting. I don't know if you know who I am. I was a Presbyterian minister. I still am. I just don't do it right now with a congregation for 28 years. And I see my whole church, in fact, almost the whole denomination just going full speed into virtue signaling. You know, they're happy to report every worshiper to the government and where they sat and when they sat and if they're going to open up. And they haven't even opened up. Most of them, their churches haven't even opened, haven't even gone back to be healing. They've kind of given up their whole essence of what it meant to be the gospel, the good news, the embrace of others, and have substituted it for our worst fear, and loneliness and being apart from each other and distancing ourselves, and then saying that's what Jesus wants, and or that's what virtue is, that's what goodness is, and that is a powerful, as you mentioned, propaganda trick to really take a population and turn it upside down almost. You know, I think we have however long you think human beings have been around, for millions of years we've known how to deal with crisis and how to heal and how to be healing for each other. And then suddenly we gave it all up to the experts, to science. Is science a name for the machine?
Well, science as such is just a method that is a very good method. It's mm-hmm. just examining reality, and you have a theory and you check the theory against reality. And if after all the tests that you can think of, the theory still stands, great. And then until you disprove it, it's great, you can use it as a, like, some kind of framework. But before we go anywhere, do they really report people who go to church? I mean, that's so heartbreaking.
Oh, it's the new rules in order to come back to church. You need, now they're starting about it. If you're not vaccinated, first of all, I mean, they're going to separate the vaxxed from the unvaxxed. And then you're going to be, these are the guidelines that are coming down, and I can't believe my denomination officials and everybody is just going along with them. And if you're against them, if you're saying, wait a second, this isn't right, you're branded as, you know, just a bad, you know, whatever, conspiracy theorist or whatnot, we got to go do this. And it isn't reporting for the government, of course, what they're saying, it's to keep us all healthy so we can track everybody, you know, if they've got COVID or something, but the effect of it is that you're reporting people for worship. They just don't know that you couldn't put this on us without the trick. right? You couldn't go to a church and say, you have to shut down for a year. And when you come back, you're going to report everybody to the government. And we're going to separate you from this kind of person to that type of person. You couldn't ever enforce that. But the trick of the virus has enabled that to happen in a way that's just, it's mind-reeling to me and to you, I think.
Well, it's heartbreaking because, you know, it reminds me, during the Soviet times, well, allegedly, like way before my time, it was known that priests would sometimes, you know, people, well, for a while churches were not allowed at all, but I guess for the time being, in the early Soviet Union, when they still existed in part, the priests would actually report people, or some priests would report people, whatever people said during a confession. And so that's like another completely messed up thing.
Yeah.
But this is quite horrible. And well, I mean, like my theory about it, and I think actually, like, I had a conversation with Kevin about it, I think too, that people tend to use any theoretical framework, including a religious framework, to essentially channel what they have on the inside. So if they have a lot of crap on the inside, they might become an inquisitor if they're completely sick in the head, and they might use the religious framework for like horrible cruelty. If they have good feeling, and if they really strive for to connect to the spirit in a pure way, then whatever framework they have, they will use it for that mysterious feeling. And throughout history, every system has been used for everything. So it is, in that way, it is not shocking, but in every other way, and in a practical way, it is really heartbreaking what you're saying. I had no idea.
Well, that's the church. I mean, within a week, I got three emails from different places. I've formerly lived in the state of Oregon, in Portland, and the Oregon Chess Championship was going to be, or Senior Chess Championship. And you can only enter it if you have proof of vaccination. And you can only watch it as a spectator if you have proof of vaccination. That was the first thing. And so I emailed the guy back and said, really? Remove me from your emailing list. And then these passport things, this kind of dividing people, you know, whether you've had this vaccination or whatever, makes you clean and unclean. I mean, it's crazy, and that's what I'm finding happening. There's that one, and then the church. I say we're only going to be able to open up if we do this, and then the gym. That's what it was. We had a park system in Portland, in the suburbs where we lived, in which it's really a beautiful thing. All kinds of trails and everything, as well as your taxes helped to pay for, you know, tennis courts and gyms and all this kind of thing that was public. It was cheap, like $4, and you could use it if you're a resident of the county. Well, now you can't use it unless you have been vaccinated and have proof of vaccination. Otherwise, you can use it, but you have to wear your mask and stay away from people. Right. I mean, this is the rules that are just coming out now. And we're supposed to be like, when does this thing ever end?
Well, I thought segregation was uncool. I mean, yeah, it is quite horrible. But here, you know, speaking of gyms, I don't think I am coming anywhere near a gym in the near future, just based on the fact that the amount of sanitizer they put on everything.
Oh, yeah.
It's bad for health. I mean, like, I'm not an enemy to myself, so I'm just not going in there. But on a serious note, this is just crazy. I mean, it is not crazy that the authorities are pushing for that, because clearly it has nothing to do with health. Clearly it's for surveillance and tracking and asset management, and essentially just managing people as, you know, assets. And I think people who are accepting that, they don't realize that it's not going to end with this shot or this the other shot. There's going to be this and the boosters and behavioral modification, mental health. And it's really just the first foot in the door with this thing right now. So accepting is really not prudent. Even if, no matter what people think about this medical product, even if they absolutely love and trust medical product, it's their choice. But I think what people need to understand is that the health passport has nothing to do with health, And it's just a way of management and the way of tracking everybody. And it's definitely not going to stop with those two shots. There's lots of other things that are going to be put in the same pile where, oh, we noticed that based on your DNA, you should not be eating meat. And yeah, you can maybe eat it, but then you'll have to pay high insurance. And, you know, like things like that. And that's just one of the most innocent potential implications. And I think actually in the British... In the British version, which, by the way, I think the latest news and it's scrapped. They're not doing vaccine passports anymore, which is really delightful if it proves true and if it sticks. But their system already was supposed to include like mental health, like behavioral things, and it's not just this medical product. So, but the gist of it, people really should realize that it has nothing to do with health. And even if they approve of this medical product, if they've taken it, if they love it, you know, then people are entitled to make their choices. But this has nothing to do with health. And everybody is going to be really screwed if this system stays, that for sure.
Tessalina, your website is Tessa Fights Robots, and there's an article or an essay that you wrote here. I'm an Outsider, A Story of Freedom. And I really was moved by it, as among another things. I could pick any of them and find them. Great stuff here. But really, really insightful. But you talk about happiness and talk about joy. And you say you're a happy person. How do you do that?
Well, I've worked on that, and also I try to, well, it is actually true. Well, for one, I did escape the sex trafficker, and I did escape the abusive relationship and all the crap that was associated with that. And just on a logical level, I'm alive, I'm here, I'm one piece, and I'm enjoying walking outside in the sun and, you know, health and all those things. It's actually not a small deal if you compare it to like having been in danger and God knows what could have happened and like everything is fine nonetheless. So that makes me happy, kind of perspective. So I think that it is actually fairly typical for people who have gone through something harsh. Then you really start appreciating things in the everyday and you don't sweat too much. Like you don't sweat petty things too much, which is, of course, in theory, it sounds just this, yeah, like, you know, everybody says that, whatever, like fluffy stuff. But it's just a feeling. I mean, I guess I really make a focused effort to be happy and try to be in balance and try to do the right thing, which I think adds to happiness. Because when you... And it doesn't mean that I'm always like on point or that I don't make mistakes. Obviously, everybody does, and I'm human. But I try, and I think that it actually does really contribute to the state of happiness. Because when you try to do the right things at all times, as much as possible, like at all times, then your conscience is clear, and it's easier to be happy. And also, I do trust genuinely in the overall wisdom of the universe. And that is especially helpful right now because the times are crazy. The reform that they're trying to push on us is huge and dark and cruel and quite frightening, really, if you look at it just from a logical perspective. Because just the whole, you know, what they're trying to do to the environment and to us and to every living form by introducing like those nanoparticles, genetic engineering, all those things that are vast and that kind of pollution, people don't even know how to get rid of it and what kind of impact it can have on health. And even if we pretend that there's no chance of truly dark agendas, which is questionable because, you know, but even if we pretend that just the pure hubris and the things that they're trying to do biologically, without any understanding of how any of that works and what kind of implications there could be long-term, it is horrifying. And smart dust and smart fabric and all those like nanoparticles and nanosensors and everything. So that's incredible pollution. That's awful. So if we just think that, okay, so here's me and here's all those super wealthy trying to do all those horrible things, then it is depressing and scary. So I think we do need help from the universe, and depending on how people believe, you know, from God, from nature, from however they think about it. But I do think that we are not alone in this world, and I think that when we bring out that love and that courage in us for real, not just, not theoretically, not to pretend, not to look cool, but for real, I think that something magical happens and something mysterious happens, and then we'll find solutions, and hopefully we'll receive a lot of help from the universe and from nature to solve all that.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, the monster. I think it's kind of perhaps connected to the machine. I mean, I felt it because I keep wanting to tell everybody there's a monster. I see this monster, and nobody wants to see this monster with me, in part because they don't want to be what I am. And it's kind of like, anxious and worried and fearful and all of this kind of thing. And no wonder nobody wants to see the monster, because they don't want to end up like me. Yet at the same, and so there's a sense in which we have to find a way to communicate the monster's presence without being overtaken by the monster in our heart.
And absolutely. And I just wrote an essay about it yesterday. I don't know if you saw it. Maybe you didn't, but that was exactly about that.
Well, I think that was that the one with the, let me see if I can get it. I'm looking at your website here on my phone. Of course.
Well, it's on Substack. It's on Tessa.substack.
Oh, okay. I might not have that. It isn't this one with the forget it. I can't find it. You tell me. You go ahead.
It is called On Fear of Monster and Fanaticism. Yeah, that's what it's
okay,
called.
Okay.
And it's on my Substack, which is also Tessa Fights Robots. But I talk about how it's important, even though the dangers we're looking at are grand, but how important it is to not be overtaken by fear and not to become fanatical about people who don't share the exact view that we have. Because then if we do, then we kind of end up taking the side of the monster with different talking points. So I think it is very, very important, especially for people who fight the good fight, to essentially confront the fear that we feel by logic, because again, it's very scary. But I think the way to get at it is to order the fear to go away and to just insist that we're entitled to joy and that we're entitled to love, and we are going to live this way no matter what.
Spiritually, what do you see as the spiritual picture of this in some way? And I'm not trying to be, religious. I'm just trying to say, what is there a bigger story at work here? Is this kind of a battle of good and evil in some form or another? Do the good guys win at the end?
Well, you know, depending on how you define philosophically, like good and evil are always relative in some way. So what's good for one is not so good for the other.
Uh-huh.
But in terms of, say, love versus fear or love versus the machine, it is that battle. But I think historically it is almost like it is a continuation of the same battle that has been going on for centuries now. I have a lot of respect for the indigenous traditions. And I think that when people used new religions to attack nature, well, it maybe didn't have anything to do with the nature of the new religions, but the people reenacted their own fear of nature. And they told the indigenous people that their way of living was bad, that nature was the devil, that it was sinful, it was scary, that having a good relationship with nature was sinful, and sex was bad, and human connection was bad, and they had to be miserable. So that was kind of phase one of that thing. And then, well, there's a story that I like to tell. I think, again, people use any system that they have to justify what they feel inside. Like, for instance, in Moscow, there is a place. They used to be a pagan sacred place, like many, many centuries ago. Then when the Slavic people were converted to Orthodox Christianity by force. And by force is the key word, because nobody wanted to. And it was blood, like as usual, like any conversion. And so they destroyed that sacred space and they built a Christian church. Then the Christian church stood there for some while, and when Bolsheviks won, they of course destroyed the church and they built a swimming pool. And then when the Soviet Union fell, the new authorities destroyed the swimming pool and built this really gaudy church. Like it doesn't feel real. It's just this cultural symbol, like very, very gaudy. But that seems like, as you see, you know, systems changed, but the principle of, okay, now it's going to be my thing. And like you guys were horrible and now it's going to be my thing, my new thing, my new reform thing. It's kind of a human, I don't know, the way I see it, it's misguided creativity, because we're all born with this desire to co-create the world in a way. And it is a very sacred, like it is a very powerful thing. It is great potential. But I think when something on the inside breaks, people, they still have this potential and they try to use it to essentially create havoc. And lots and lots of different systems and belief systems have been used this way to just destroy something. And I think right now we're essentially going through a religious reform where this time around the ideology is transhumanist and the talking points are transhumanists. And the way originally the indigenous people were declared backwards and bad and, you know, savages and they don't know what they're doing, they need to be converted. Similarly, today biological, natural humans are declared bad and backward, and they need to be converted and genetically modified and essentially plugged into this new system. But I think that the principle, the underlying principle of plugging people into systems, is that is where the fault lies, and that's where it's broken, because, you know, we're not machines.
And that's and that's the case now. I mean, now the technology is such at a place and the oligarchs' control of it can make it happen more than any other time in history, perhaps. I mean, it's not David and Goliath anymore. It's David versus Megatron, as someone wrote on Facebook. You know, it is really the capability now with satellites all over. But it is a psychological training, isn't it? This masking and the social distancing, 6 feet, as if, you know, 6 feet. Well, what's keep 6 feet apart from the other? Because that's how far we bury people in the ground, right? 6 feet under. We're dead to each other. And it's a training that we're being trained for this. Yeah, I think you're on this transhumanist thing to become something different, to become plugged in, to become the machine.
Well, unfortunately, I think that is the case. And I think the people who are driving that, they're so broken as human beings. They're so completely divorced from physical reality and from joy and from, I mean, they could be very rich, but they still could be very miserable. Like I heard, for instance, that Ray Kurzweil, who is considered to be the father of singularity, and he has all those absolutely insane propositions about the future of humanity. And strangely, to my complete befuddlement, he also has a ton of funding from seemingly intelligent people who support this singularity, and that has been for years. But I heard that he's also a very miserable lad. So I don't know why would anybody would want to live forever while being miserable, which then makes me think maybe he doesn't really believe in it. Maybe it's just a gimmick. Maybe he's just selling immortality as his like unique selling proposition, which makes it even more insane. But yeah, they're trying that. And I can't believe they're actually doing that, because I have been writing about big tech and making art about big tech and this whole machine versus human situation. I've been doing that for a few years before 2020. And I was kind of concerned about it, but I thought that surely that was going to happen after my lifetime. But yeah, I mean, that was a big danger and they were crazy, but I could not even imagine that it would start happening, that they would try to do it during my lifetime. So I'm tripping over that. It's completely insane.
And all these students going to school and they're all excited about taking robotics. What are you taking? What do you know what you're taking? Tessalina is my guest. If you're just joining us, this is Freedom Loves Company. My name is John Scheck, a new show on Revolution Radio, revolution.radio. Tessa makes love. Tessa fights robots. The Tessa makes love part is the name of your band. And I want to talk about music because music has also been sacrificed through this. No live music. People can't go out and sing and certainly as much as possible as we used to before. And now, they're talking about, well, with concerts come back, everybody has to be vaccinated and socially distant and all this stuff. Taking music away certainly takes away our spirit and our humanity. Your music, tell us about it a little bit. What drives it for you? And is there a sense in which you that music, do you think, can bring back our humanity, that connects us to our spirituality?
Well, music is a very powerful thing, and thank you for bringing it up. At some point a few months ago, somebody suggested, I think in Britain, they were seriously discussing bringing back musicals without singing, which is quite amazing. But, music is, a lot of the music power comes from doing it together and being in person and being yourself. So the whole social distancing there is insane. And I'm quite disappointed at some of my music heroes, coming back, coming from Moscow. I held some of the Western, rock and roll stars almost sacred in a sense, just from my teen years. And I thought they were so brave and rebellious. And all of a sudden, some of them go, let's do social distance dancing. And I'm thinking, really? Seriously? Like, you're not joking. So that makes me think that maybe in that sense I lived a lie. And maybe they were never really rebellious. Maybe they were just spoiled kids who wanted to, have attention, which nothing wrong with wanting attention. But maybe they really never were rebellious. And I just created this idea in my head because I wanted to believe that they were. So maybe 2020 and 2021, maybe they're just kind of putting things in their places, and people who were square, they kind of just went all the way square, and then people who are trying to be real are still trying to be real. And I'm not saying that all of that is set in stone, because I think for everybody the goal is to be completely awakened, and people can be square for years and then maybe something happens and then they can, something brings them to their most sacred and most alive humanity. But as far as just choices right now, so maybe everybody just kind of continued being who they were, just now the circumstance is different. What do you think?
I think you could be right on that. It's just heartbreaking for me to see a concert here at a local venue, college really, and they're singing, but they all have to wear face masks. How can you sing with a face mask on? And it was just so disheartening. But yet I live at a place that it's a little more open. And so finally we had a spring concert and it was kind of back to normal a little bit. And it was so refreshing. It brought tear to my eyes. It really did, to see people singing together without the masks and without being apart from each other. And that's connected to worship. I think that's why churches have been closed down too, because you sing together, and that's one of the few places that people go, really, bars and churches, to sing. And when that was taken away, I just kind of wonder if there was an intentionality about shutting down the power of music. And if that's the case, then it really is also our, perhaps a target, a goal for our liberation, our freedom, is to insist on continuing to make music together.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you. And by the way, as you were talking, I realized that I kind of unintentionally dissed the actual question that you asked. So speaking of my music, what drives me, I guess...
Yes.
Well, I've had this thing to... I've always wanted to understand what life is about and what the true, this mysterious true thing is. And I've had this desire and this thirst ever since I remember myself. So I guess this is a big part that drives my music. And in the past several years, I was mostly making art and music about this whole technocratic machine, the soul of the machine versus the soul of a human being. So I had this show, a theatrical almost show with poetry and like interesting things about robots and feeling and love and being alone and not being alone and all those things. And almost now I feel like I don't want to do that art anymore because now it's reality. So I was doing it as a warning, as an artistic warning. And now it's our life. So it's almost like I don't want to reinforce it. I want to do something entirely different. No, not entirely, but something that is far more elevating. And luckily in my circles here in New York, like I have a group of friends and they play traditional African music, which is absolutely beautiful. And so they played at some events here and that was so liberating. So I can completely understand the feeling that you're describing. The first event that I went to with live music and people and actual hugging, that was such a powerful experience. I mean, like, who of us thought that that would be a big deal, that we would have this appreciation for just going to see a band? So that is quite amazing.
And I have a hope that that feeling will be strong enough for people to resist the next lockdown wave. I hope so.
I mean, like, in New York, it's very strange.
Yeah.
Because people here somehow just went for it just like that. And I don't know. This is strange. Very, very strange to me.
Well, I mean, in New York City is all about, what, plays, right? Theater. And is that happening in New York? Are theaters opening up?
Well, now some theaters require the employees to take the you-know-what, and It is very bizarre. And it is very strange how a lot of people in New York kind of folded to this. Like, not so many people in my circle. I consider myself lucky because I have a lot of people who just didn't go for it, like, in my circle. But just generally, I think they really scared New Yorkers last year with all the nonstop coverage and, you know, especially when it was the quarantine and, you know, the lockdown, all those sirens in the street, like all you hear, like this complete silence and then all the sirens and like all you hear. So I think that a lot of people were so deeply traumatized that, especially the people who could actually work from home, because that made a huge difference for people. Those who could work from home, and ultimately, so they were scared, they were traumatized, but they didn't lose their income, which kind of worked out for them. But then people who relied on the physical world, I think they got cured of being scared very quickly. Because I remember even a few months ago, like almost late spring or summer, people he would see without masks would be firefighters, police, sometimes nurses, medical receptionists, cashiers who could get away with it. So there were people who were actually functioning in the physical world. But then people who would work from home, they were terrified. And that's, of course, a generalization because it depends on the person, but just as an average in my subjective experience. So I guess physical reality is important and we're impacted by it.
Tessalina, we just have a couple of minutes left, but and I really thank you for being my guest. And tell me a little bit about your venues, your websites and whatever, and what you're working on now.
Well, I'm writing a lot of essays around this existential issues related to the pandemic and actual analysis and research. I chose to mostly write about the pandemic on my Substack that has existed now for, well, less than a year, but it's doing okay. So it's tessa.zessa.substack.com. And so I put a lot of soul into writing about it. I also have a podcast that is called Make Language Great Again. And I try to interview very interesting people to talk about all those things that matter. Like, I interviewed Mark Crispin Miller and a bunch of really interesting, very, very heartful, very soulful, brave people. And I also am looking for ways to try to rebuild the physical community, because that is the main thing. And I think last year has shown to everybody that we really need each other, like physically, touching, hugging, all those things. And that's where I'm at.
Absolutely. We definitely do that. Thank you for your good work and for your honesty and for your candidness in your articles and in your music and on your podcast. Tessa Lena, my guest on Freedom Loves Company. And, you know, it's this thinking is I've just started getting my podcast back up again, and I'm realizing the importance of creativity and doing the things that we want to do and need to do and love to do. It does get you out of the fear and the just the, oh my gosh, the monster's so big. I'm not going to be able to deal with it, because we have to. We have to be human all the way through and find that joy and find that love and find that creativity and find that spirit. And you're one of those people. And so I'm very appreciative for you and your work, and all the best to you.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
You have been listening to Freedom Loves Company on ProgressiveSpirit.net. This broadcast originally aired live on Revolution Radio. It has been slightly edited for distribution to radio stations, including the Pacifica Radio Network. Catch Freedom Loves Company live every Sunday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Revolution.radio Studio B. Find podcasts at ProgressiveSpirit.net and JohnShuck.com. I'm John Shuck. Be well.